Where do we go in our culture when a Jewish student can't speak up on their own campus without being feared of being attacked? Where do we go in our culture when a student can't question the actions of a foreign government, in this case Israel, for fear of being blamed and smeared, as I was defamed by the Chicago Tribune Guild as an anti-Semite, which is really chilling? Where are we going? As Mayor Daley used to say, where are we going in this kind of society? To answer this and to talk about it, we have Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, our friend, writer of many, many articles and speeches and books. And Jeff Carlin is here, Executive Producer, WGN Radio, my friend. And me, I'm John Cass, Editor-in-Chief of johncassnews.com. $50 a year, $5 a month. You can read my columns and get this podcast free. And where are you as the Democrat experiment begins to fall apart, as they start screaming like blithering idiots locked, or lunatics locked in a Victorian insane asylum? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, we are speaking to our friend, Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, writer of many articles. He writes for The Spectator, Spectator World, The Telegraph. Here's a few headlines. Donald Trump calls for a renewal of American patriotism. Hear, hear, Charles. What is behind the vicious attacks on Elon Musk and Democrats built America's overmighty presidency? Now Trump is bending it to his will.
I think they didn't realize that anybody could come in who didn't govern within the broad arc that Franklin Roosevelt and then later FDR built. There were Republican presidents, but with the exception of Reagan, they all governed within this broad framework, progressive framework that had been established starting in the 1930s. And now they're finding the president is turning it all against them. And it's a shock.
I said, yeah, it's a shock to say the least. I mean, the spinning heads, and as we kind of, you know, we talked about this last year towards the end of the year, how yeah. Trump's presidency was going to be this ink blot for like the zeitgeist of, you know, half of people are going to see it for one thing, half of people are going to see it for the other, but it's going to be really identifying when, you know, the rubber hits the road. And we're seeing that in real time. You know, there is no cohesive march on Washington, or there's no, this is the person who's, you know, coming out and trying to take Trump to task or get in the way. It's just kind of this weird free for all that doesn't, is no structure whatsoever. Is there a worry, and this is why I always love talking to you, Charles, is there a worry that the power that he is using, which, you know, for a long time many Republicans have said is not you know, extrajudiciary, it's beyond the scope of what the Constitution allows. You know, see Obama, and you can go back to Clinton. I mean, there's a lot of it. Do you think that once we wedge that power band open, we can never kind of call it back, and that that damage then becomes, you know, dictatorial in the future?
I don't know that it becomes dictatorial, because we still have courts that can say whether things are constitutional. We mm-hmm. still have a Congress, which may not always be in the president's control. But the Constitution says that all executive power shall be in the hands of a president. It doesn't mm-hmm. say some of it. It says all
can
of it.
Can you tell that to Amy Coney Barrett, please? Just can you drop her a note?
I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on
right.
TV. But my understanding is that part of the issue for Amy Coney Barrett had to do with some technical aspects of what went on. But boy, was she blasted by Alito. I think the big story here is that the Democrats have two or three fundamental problems. The first is that they won't have a real leader until they nominate somebody for president in 4 years, 3.5 years. The second is that all their old leaders who would normally step into that position in the interim have mm-hmm. been discredited. So that's a serious problem for them.
Or debilitated, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then the third?
The third is that the party has moved so far to the left that they can win in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Oregon and Illinois, but they can't win in or they have a real difficulty winning in Michigan and Wisconsin and Montana and a lot of other
New York.
Exactly. Well, a lot of these states, if they're next to a red state, like Illinois is next to a well-governed red state, Indiana. You have, what is it, 33 counties in Illinois that would like to join Indiana? The same is true in Oregon.
We don't want them here. Exactly.
But the point is, what you're seeing is people are voting with their feet. They're moving to South Florida. A well-governed state. They're moving to Texas. They're moving to Tennessee. In fact, Nashville is now extremely expensive. I just saw that Chattanooga it has a hot housing market. And of course, Texas is where a lot of the country's growth is occurring. So people are moving with their feet, and the incompetence of governance in the blue states is what's driving them out. The Democrats have one final problem that I don't think has been fully recognized. The Democrats' policies, really since Lyndon Johnson, has been to create a democratic socialist state. With very high taxes, a lot of social services, all paid for by the central government. Franklin Roosevelt began with Social Security. Lyndon Johnson added Medicare and Medicaid. And, of course, the war on poverty, which has a lot of transfer payments associated with it. And then Barack Obama added the last key piece, which is universal health care. So that leaves the Democrats with a problem. What do they want to do now that they fulfilled their big agenda? And all Biden could do was throw more money at existing programs, and that did not work out well.
The state of the Democrats, it is just delicious to me that they are completely falling apart, as evidenced by catastrophe of the react to the president's State of the Union speech. I mean, congressional address. And I'm wondering you're the historian here. Can you please tell us what happened to the Jacobins after the French Revolution because I see these people less as Democrats and more as Jacobins who are like of the French Revolution type. And I wondered what happened to them.
Well, it didn't work out well for the Jacobins. It did not work out well. They ruled for a while, and then they, you know, a lot of them came into power at 5 foot eight and left at 4 foot eight.
Oh, yeah, right.
They have moved pretty far to the left. And what I posted on my, just on Facebook today, was a Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck cartoon. And the point of it was that whatever Bugs said, Daffy would say the opposite. So Daffy was saying duck season. So he's telling Elmer Fudd to shoot the duck. I mean, you know, that's what that's what the bunny is saying, Bugs Bunny. And then Daffy Duck says, rabbit season. But then Bugs, being a clever soul, says, switches. He says, rabbit season. And Daffy Duck says, duck season, fire. And of course, he's fired on. He's the loser. And that's exactly what's happened to the Democrats. Trump very deliberately went after them. I mean, I don't think there was any question that he was trying to provoke them. And the more they reacted, the more he was willing. I mean, he called out Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas. I mean, you know, but his best line, I mean, his best line was his opening line, America is back. And he said one other thing. He hung the Biden presidency around their neck. I thought he might move on from that. But as long as it is as unpopular as it is, he wants to hang it around their neck. And what he had one line in there that was so brilliant about immigration. And, of course, immigration is a huge plus for Trump and for all Republicans. And Biden, you'll remember, kept saying we need new laws. And then Trump, in that address, said all we needed was a new president.
Yeah, it was the best line of the night as far as
really, it was a great line. My sense is that the Democrats are in complete disarray, and that what you'll see is a fight between the coastal types and the Midwest center left, excluding Illinois, which is much more like the coasts.
I don't see them doing anything until they can, I guess, present the figurative, not literal head, figurative head of Barack Obama to the American people. I mean, they are so lost. They have no leadership. They have no direction. They have no message. And just the other day, I heard one of the high priests at MSNBC from the Democrat side compared Trump to Mussolini. Yeah. And I was thinking, it reminded me of, since we're in the movie season, it reminded me of the old Dracula movies where Renfield, the person who's corrupted by Dracula, begins shouting, "The blood is the life, the blood is the life," and he begins eating bugs in order, you know, like some lunatic in a Victorian asylum. And that's what worries me. I mean, I don't think it's good for the country for the Democrats to be that crazy, but they are.
I agree with that. I would say that what you have is they cry wolf, there's no wolf, and their decision is to cry wolf squared. There's no wolf squared. They cry wolf to the power of three. And they've just escalated and escalated, and it's put them in a very bad position. Having said all of that, I think that the real risk for the Republicans is a recession. If there is a recession, the Democrats won't have to put forward any positive program. They'll just say that Trump screwed up the economy.
Right. They will. They will do that. Before that happens, though, we'll see what happens with Congress. I think they can get this thing through some sort of cuts and spending issues. But there are other things I want to bring up to you. One is, okay, freedom of speech. I'm one of those people who, I'm a free speech absolutist. I don't want people to be jailed for opposing foreign government action. Like,
right.
I'm an American. If I want to stand up and criticize Israel, I think I have the right to.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to be cast as demonized like the Tribune editorial, the Tribune Guild did, and you defended me from them when they defamed me as an anti-Semite for daring to question the wisdom of George Soros electing all these Cook County prosecutors and state prosecutors throughout the country.
Right.
And you defended me, thank you, sir. But where do we stand now? Can I criticize?
Well, I was glad to defend you, but I still hadn't received the check.
That's a Chicago in.
There you go. That's
no, really. No, the free speech issue on campus is a very serious one, and I think it's serious in the whole country. Yes. We have a lot of intimidation. We have people who are being silenced, and we have people on campus who are wearing masks, taking over buildings. And the Department of Justice has put 10 universities, beginning with Columbia, on their list for failing to protect their students and being in violation of basic civil rights law in their failure. And what's so striking to someone who grew up in the 50s, where virulent anti-Semitism all came from the right, and there is still some on the extreme right, but all of this is coming from elite universities and what is supposed to be liberal or progressive or left-wing environment. They're not progressive. They're not liberal. They're not tolerant. And I've got to tell you, it's not just the students. It's almost the entire faculty in the humanities and what might be called the soft social sciences, that is everything except economics and so forth. And the staff at these universities is a problem as well. My sense is that, I mean, one of the interesting things, I don't know that the public really understands this, but Jewish families are now sending their children to major universities in the South, that is from the Northeast and from Chicago. They're going to the University of Alabama, to Ole Miss, to the University of Georgia.
Because they want their kids to be safe.
Right.
You can't be safe. I mean, so right. On one hand, I support the president stripping $400 million or whatever it is from Columbia because they have failed repeatedly to protect the civil rights of their Jewish students, any students.
Right.
On the other hand, I want free inquiry on campus so that kids can condemn or stand up and be kids and be idiotic as kids.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the choosing sides. That's the thing that I think has been, and you've seen the pushback against that. It's like universities coming out and officially saying, well, you know, we support their chance, their message, or like grow this or pro that. And when it's an official statement on stuff about what's going on in Gaza or whatever, it's like that mentality that the university is some sort of entity that we need to have a stance from, right? The students can have the stance. The university should be, yeah, okay, well, that's happening. You know, let the students figure out what the future should be because that's where their job is.
Take the money, off right? The damn that's mask.
That's the thing is where it's one sided, and I think that if it's federal money, that's the whole point. You know, it's got to be you got to play fair if you want federal money, and I think that's in all honestly well, not an attack on the First Amendment.
You're very much right, Jeff, and I would say that the University of Chicago came up with a policy in the late 1960s in the midst of the Vietnam War demonstrations. That has now been widely adopted across the country. And the policy basically says universities shouldn't take public policy positions unless there's some overriding academic interest in that. Mm-hmm. For example, I think it's perfectly fine to revoke the student visas of students who have violated the law. But a university that wanted to speak out against that, I would say that they would be speaking out on behalf of students rather than the public policy position on Gaza or something.
Right.
On the other hand, the main point of this doctrine, which is sometimes called Calvin, spelled with a K, Calvin,
yes.
Is that the spokesman, the debaters, the people mm-hmm. who put forward their points of view at the university
right.
should be the faculty and the students, not the Department of Political Science, not
right.
the deans. So even if every single member of the political science department thought we should continue giving financial support, military support to Ukraine, the political science department should not say that. We can have a private petition in which we all sign it if we want, but not the political science department. And the I'm part of a free speech listserv mm-hmm. at the University of Chicago.
Right.
All the violations come from the left, every single one.
Sure.
And yes. you cannot stop them. They're just right. Because what happens is that you report it to the provost's office, and then the provost says, well, you know, why can't it's the Rodney King. Why can't we all just get along? And my own view is that what will stop this is when every provost who's the number two in a university wants mm-hmm. to become president of another university. Everyone.
Sure.
And as soon as they start to think that if they crack down on this kind of mischief, they'll more likely to lose a job than to win a job, nothing will happen. As soon as they realize that they'll never become president of Cornell if they're the number two at Chicago, they'll never become president of Penn if they're number two of Chicago, unless they crack down on this misbehavior. But right now, it's the opposite.
And I think, and also the students, see, the thing that's deceptive and I think unfair and mm-hmm. weaselly is that if they're not citizens of the United States, if they're here on a student visa, mm-hmm. I don't see the problem in having their visas revoked and sent back. Enjoy yourself. Go back to Gaza. You want to be here? Keep your mouth shut and don't ruin some other student's education. Is that draconian of me? Is that like wrong of me to think that?
I haven't thought it through completely, John. But my inclination is to say that a student who is in the country, as long as he or she is not supporting a terrorist organization,
right,
should have free speech rights. So if a student comes in, let's say, from Mexico, and says and wants to say out loud, I oppose Trump closing the border. As far as I'm concerned, that's fine. If what they want to do is block traffic or close down a building on campus, then I think their visa should be it should be possible to revoke their visa. And if I were in charge, I would.
That sounds reasonable. And if they stand to support Hamas or Trende Aragua, lose right. your visa. Enjoy your trip back home because right. you're not going to come
and,
back.
So yeah. I would say on that, though, it's a sad thing that Washington has to step in where the administrators at Columbia or UCLA or University or Northwestern, which Northwestern is one of the 10 universities on the list of not yes. protecting their students. It's a serious matter, and it's been irresponsible of the people who run these universities not to step in. And whole departments have become just sewers of political correctness. Not it's worse than correctness. I mean, they really punish you if you're any different.
Progressive Olympics.
Right.
Pardon me?
It's a progressive Olympics, you know.
The progressive Olympics. I hadn't heard that. That's right. That's right.
I mean, exactly. If you're not progressive enough, you're off the team. Right. It's scary. Charles, one of the things you alluded to is that you know, the idea that you don't want an official, quote, on paper stance or whatever from a department to be like, hey, this is what we feel about this political situation right. or whatever. Right. But all the members of that department then just saying, you know, signing a letter together, you know, sends it. It's obviously the right to do that. I would advise against it because I think it then sends the same message to the students of that department and, you know, saying, well, if all of my teachers who I'm supposed to look up to, you know, it's kind of, it becomes murky. And in a sense, I feel like it should be more, you know, my politics are private in that sense. Like I don't need to be public and front forward facing. How
That's
do you bridge that
point.
Gap?
That's a great point. When I was in college, I didn't know the politics of any of my right. teachers except the ones who had actually served in a presidential administration, which several had. But I didn't know they didn't. My own viewpoints, not necessarily political viewpoints, but my own viewpoints were fairly public. And so I didn't feel like it was, I felt like it might even be misleading to try to hide them, but I wanted students to understand that their grade was in no way contingent on their agreeing with me. I always used to tell them they didn't have to agree with me. They could just be wrong. But they understood it was a joke, but for right. many faculty members, it's not a joke. Right. If you, they think that agreeing with them is the only morally correct
right.
View to have. And that's fundamentally illiberal. It's right. intolerant.
And I think that's the biggest, by far biggest flaw in our education All system right now is this idea that teachers, and it's not just, you know, teachers are at fault, you know,
right.
it's also lays on parents because how many parents are, you know, hand off their kids and say, well, you know, you're in charge now, fix it. And then when things aren't right, then they go after the teacher. And the teachers are in this tough point. The teachers should not be, you know, we should not be the arbiters of what's necessarily good and bad. Right and wrong is different, but you know, it's the idea of putting forth protecting your own ids and isms right. to people right. is so dangerous because you wind up, what if you get it wrong? You know, there's a whole idea of it. You know, everyone can be wrong.
Right.
Yeah. But so speak well spoken from a physics major.
Right.
Right?
No, that's,
now, that, you're, but I
you're think, exactly but right. I think, but I think what yeah. changed, Jeff, is COVID.
Right.
People saw
yeah, and on the dining room table in the middle of
because it was being
mom and dad's working two steps over.
at the dining room table. And by the way, I think that the politicization of K-12 is one of the things that's driving the privatization.
It's not helping
of schooling movement.
Yeah. Well, look at the test scores and look at the blue states that are run by teachers. Like Illinois is run by the Chicago. Illinois Democrats are controlled by the Chicago Teachers Union. Yes.
Well, they're the most powerful organization in the state. Yeah. They're more powerful, I think, than the Organized Democratic Party.
Well, they are the Democratic Party.
It used to be that you could say, well, all we need to do is put more money into the schools. But we've done that for 30, 40 years. We've put a lot of money into the schools, and we're not getting better results. Now, I'm not saying that that's all the fault of the schools. More students may be coming in from families where the parents don't read to them or don't teach them the importance of discipline. You can't correct everything at school, but K-12 is a big problem, and I think that and some of the majors at some of these colleges are not helping students. They're not giving them the skills that they need to go out into the job market, and they're not giving them the liberal education that's the other part of a good university education, where you should be reading Jane Austen and you should be reading Plato's Socratic dialogues and so forth.
But repeating the views of your superiors like a parrot,
right,
might not provide for education, but it does provide for employment, particularly in journalism. If you're a kid who want, you know, just find your editor's politics and then just prattle on whatever they say and change that, right?
The surveys of the politics of faculty and ed schools is even worse than literally there are no Republicans who teach in a journalism school. You may be able to find one, but I talked to somebody who's an on-air personality who went to the University of Missouri Journalism School and stays in close contact. He says there's not a single Republican on that faculty. I think that the role of journalism is changing. There's no reason for a four-year journalism degree. You should major in economics or political science or sociology or English. You should take a few courses.
Specialize in.
You should take a few courses and maybe a summer's worth of courses, or it should be a minor. And I would say that the same is probably true for teaching, but you would be a better guide on that, Jeff, than I. I mean, I would say that a science major
It depends on the genre. I mean, obviously, because he was talking secondary education, not even secondary, but like in high school, it's much different. You know, 7, 8,
that's right.
12. You could do it there in a specialization, you know, nature. But I think that the ability to teach and the biggest, I think, hurdle or the toughest thing to put forth as a teacher is identifying students who need extra help, need certain tools, and knowing the pathways and the tools and how to use those tools them elevated to the level you want them to be at. And I don't think you can do that as a minor. I think it's got to be an education. I mean, this program
that's
is a teaching program that has a secondary minor in physics, but it's part of the, it's a physics program under the education banner.
I'm open-minded about this. You know more than I do. That's a great point. Sounds to me like go ahead.
Well, I think what you're talking about is could be corrected in a cultural shift, And I think we're, you know, we've seen some of that. The idea of the migration to state, you know, colleges in the South and colleges that are less, you know, a big, crazy liberal, hair-burning universities. I think you've seen that those schools are losing numbers. I mean, I know U of I's had trouble getting international students to keep the numbers or ratios up. And there are numbers across the board in a lot of major schools, liberal schools. So I think we're going to get to that point. I think the cultural shift towards not being an indoctrinator, not having a classroom that says, you know, all the things I believe and on the wall behind me, but again, just listen to the story I'm telling you. Don't pay attention to any of that. Like this idea that, you know, mm-hmm. that like he's billboarding my beliefs to the students and then teaching them a side of education is been so forward in an education because society has been super, you know, liberal since the 90s, you know, since kind of the whiplash against the Reaganism kind of mentality among mainstream culture, middle class mm-hmm. culture, whatever, in my lifetime. And now I think we're going to whipsaw the other way. And I worry about what the double blowback is, right? You know, if we can alter ourselves, get us to the point where education makes sense again, are we going to get, well, now we're confident in this. Are we going to push back into being progressive too much and then be back where we were? You know, that's my
fears. Well, I'm going back to college. I want to take courses again because I think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I never graduated from university and I've always wanted to. I've thought of the idea. I've done reading. I've done a little bit of reading on my own, but that's not enough. You have to, I think the discipline of, and I found a college that I wanted to try. You really? Guys may have heard of it. Hillsdale College. I want to start with their history department. I want to read the other Greeks and other the Athens, the Peloponnesian War, and so forth. I'm interested in the Book of Genesis as a literary subject of inquiry, and I think I've found out that I can do this if I involve myself in the online courses that they offer at Hillsdale. I don't know. I think I need that discipline again in my life. Just, I mean, I'm not going to be in a dorm room smoking a bong, you know, watching like March Madness. Not
that there's anything wrong with that.
I know. but I do think that writing papers for others than yourself, it might be a way to do
well,
that.
Well, I have a treat for you, John.
Yeah.
Every Sunday I do a 1 hour Zoom session. It's not a podcast. It's just a Zoom session with several friends who uh-huh. are mostly writers. Uh-huh. One of whom I really like, and he is a history professor at Hillsdale.
Okay.
So I'm gonna put you and my friend in touch. And once you finish donating a new building on campus, you'll be, you know.
Well, that university is not hurting at all.
No, I know. They're the only university in the country, as far as I know. There may be a religious university or two that doesn't take federal money. And
that was the key. That's the key to freedom.
You know, what people don't understand about the federal money is, so, like, a lot of the rules, like rules that might tell you that you have to let a transgender person play on the women's basketball team, let's just say.
Is that also the rule that 5'8" Greeks and Jews should be starting in Big Ten basketball?
I used to tell people that. While I was an undergraduate, I went to Yale, and when I was an undergraduate at Yale, during the 4 years I was there, the team did not lose a single game. They tied one very famously, but they didn't lose a single game. And they said, well, boy, it must be a great team. I said, let me tell you, we had a wide receiver named Weinstein. So it's not like he was running the 100-yard dash in 9.3, you know. Right. The rules. So I want to go back to so transgender in sports, and I should say right away, I'm perfectly fine with people identifying with whatever gender if they're an adult. Right. So this is not
goes without saying
anti-LGBTQ statement.
Yeah, no. That's right. By no it's means. Not. No, I want people to be happy in who they are. That's a different thing from sports. That's a different thing from how children should be handled. It's a different thing from schools not telling parents.
Yes. But
I want to go back to Hillsdale and this. So what happens with something like the federal rules, there's no money that's going to the University of Chicago for their intramural basketball program, right? So where's the leverage? The leverage is that they threaten to cut off all the money for science.
Right.
That's where the money comes in. So Hillsdale didn't want to be subject to that leverage, but then they're also not a research university, right? Primarily, you just couldn't do that if you had people who were working on expensive microbiology projects or physics.
Right.
They need federal money. So I think that what you're seeing in the case of Trump is he's not saying, for the most part, that the federal government shouldn't be doing this. He's saying that the substantive policies that the federal government pursues should be different from the ones they are. I personally think the federal government is doing a lot of things it shouldn't be doing. Take this high-speed rail in California, which has been a fiasco, right? It's been a fiasco. But I want to ask a different question. Why should transportation between Los Angeles and San Francisco, that's exclusively what it is. It's not part of an interstate highway system that connects a whole bunch of states and everything. Why should a taxpayer in Illinois or Mississippi or Massachusetts pay for that? It should be a purely a state project.
Agreed. Agreed. 100%.
I mean, the only argument you can make for it is that it's the quantity of people being served as a gross number against the total population, right? You know, if it's 100 million people, sure. Okay. Maybe it makes sense to throw some federal money at it, but that's not the case. I mean, how many people need high speed rail?
I felt the same way when, you know, the Trump administration stopped the state of New York from imposing a congestion fee on traffic in Manhattan. Frankly, right. I mean, you know, that's Manhattan's problem. I don't see any role that the federal government should be playing there. Even if I agreed, I have no opinion.
That tells me that New Jersey is in play, is what that tells me.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Jeez, John. Not all politics are local. Gosh. No, I mean, you're right.
In Mississippi, all politics are yokel.
Throw some rolls. Where is that place that you told me about?
Oh, man. That is a favorite place. It's called Lambert's, and it's in the Boot Heel of Missouri near Sykeston. And if people who are listening to this, I'm sure some people have gone there. Lambert's, home of the Throwed Rolls. And you order what in the South is called a meat and two or a meat and three, that is maybe chicken and two vegetables. And
is ham a vegetable?
Huh?
Is ham a vegetable?
Of course.
Not if you're Jewish. But what happens is then people come around with buckets of additional food like grits and so forth, fried okra, and dish it up for free to you, except for the rolls. And the rolls they throw to you. And I tell you, my favorite memory of this place, which is on the way to Memphis, which is why
right.
I have family there. So I've stopped there. And I saw a kid. He must have been, you know, 4 or 5 years old. And he's standing in the booth, and they throw him a roll, and he catches it. And you would have thought he caught the home run and a World Series game. He couldn't have been happier.
That's a true love story.
It is. There's a second Lambert's down on the Gulf Coast, which I assume is a son or daughter of the people in Missouri. But this is south of Mobile as you go to Gulf Shores. But if anybody is traveling in southern Illinois, I'm telling you, this place is fun.
Well, we're going to have to hit that place. I have to bring some insulin because there's a lot of bread in the air.
John, you look good, man. You really look good.
Yeah, well, I got to get some insulin so I can have some of those rolls, right. man, because that's what I want.
Well, there you have it. There
and you know what I also want, guys?
Yeah.
I brought up the ham because the rabbi that's talking to me is going to give me a special indulgence or dispensation. Yeah, do they do that? Does Judaism allow that? Like,
no. damn it. For you, Booby, for you, I'd do it.
Because what I'm looking for is real country ham. Real country ham. Like, salty, smoky. Where do you go for that?
There's no Cracker Barrel near you, John, in Indiana?
Just kidding.
Cracker Barrel is the official state restaurant of Indiana. it's a good question. I don't know. Don't you get the feeling that we're living in one of those moments of real change?
Yeah.
And my sense is that the people who've been running things for a long time have kind of run out of ideas and they've run out of money, and the other side is now coming at them with both barrels.
Maybe that's why they have no response to all this stuff going on, you know?
Well, when you wear a pink dress and hold up a sign that looks like a ping pong paddle that says something like, no, or whatever.
Right.
It's kind of an embarrassment, really.
And then you start thinking of Chris Murphy, Senator Murphy, as the alpha male of the group.
Well,
then you're really in trouble.
Yeah. Nobody listens to the response by the opposing party.
There was a response?
Yeah. What people say, Lisa Slotkin was pretty good. By the way, do you know where all of her family money comes from, John?
No, I know she was in the CIA, but I don't know where the money comes
but
from.
But her grandfather, who came from Minsk, you know, one of the Jews who left and so forth, ballpark francs.
No way.
See?
Yep.
Full circle.
Yeah.
You know what? Is the Ashkenazi, I think she's an Ashkenazi then. These people are off the charts with creativity and brains. I can't explain it any other way.
Well, there are
I love ballpark.
There are studies about that. Ashkenazi Jews have a median IQ of about 113 to 115 instead of 100. That helps a little, but what it really means is that if you go out and look at people with IQs of 145, 150, the group that has a median of 115 is going to be 40-50 times overrepresented at the far extreme, right? So that's where you get the Nobel Prizes in physics and all the rest. And but I've always thought that there was something, and I'm a complete amateur at this, but I've always thought that there was something kind of a bit misleading about the nature-nurture debate in the following sense. If you're, let's say you have an IQ of 125, it doesn't matter what religion, or ethnic group or race or anything, 125, you're going to find it much more interesting to read books, to play chess, to do mathematical puzzles, to take more rigorous courses. If you have,
and the expectations will be higher,
right,
on the children. That's
correct.
Oh, Dad, I made varsity. No, that's not good enough. Dad, I got straight A's. That's where we begin.
Yeah,
straight A's is where you begin. Not,
It's really true. And but if you have an IQ of 90, you're not going to be spending all day reading novels or reading history books. You're not going to find chess as fascinating as checkers. In other words, so what happens is that people with higher IQs continue to engage themselves and push themselves.
Right.
They want to go back
to college when they're go to college when they're in their late 60s, right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I mean, they find that stuff interesting.
Right.
I mean, Jeff has gone back to school so he can teach science, and that takes some not just gumption and get up and go, but a sense of intellectual interest.
Yeah, intellectual curiosity is certainly something lacking in modern American culture by far.
I think that's right. And I think that the other thing that I think that we're shortening our attention span.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the information revolution has kind of led us to that path. You know, it's the idea that everything's right at your fingertips and you don't have to think about something. You can just look it up and somebody else has already thought about it. But when we run out of things or people to look up and think about things, and we're in trouble.
Right.
We got to have another talk later about how AI is going to kill us
as a
culture. But we'll do that in another time. First, I got to get those bread rolls from the Lamberts.
Okay? Lamberts, indeed.
Jeff, I'd like to thank you for getting Charles Lipson on because...
Getting him on. Charles is always eager to be here.
I am. I'm...
You
can see me standing on a corner wearing stockings with a sign that says, we'll be on podcasts for...
We'll podcast for food.
Free, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, want a good time? Call Charles.
We're not going. We're going to treat you with the dignity that you deserve, sir.
Thank you. Finally, somebody.
For Charles Lipson.
Still in the mail.
Let me do this. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, the RITSMA Chair, writer of many articles, many articles. I read headlines to a few of them. Spectator, World, The Telegraph, you name it, Real Clear Politics, you name it. You can find his work at charleslipson.com, and you can find him on Twitter at charles_Lipson, LIPSON. And for Jeff Carlin, future physics teacher, executive producer at WGN, my friend, and a guy who is going to teach me all about omakase soon, in a few days. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way. And we'll talk to you again on the next edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.